patreon.com/thewalkoffpodcast. $4 a month gets you in there.
Baseball, Blue Jays, and more baseball. It's the walk-off with Scott Belford and Adam Mack.
This ball is crushed.
The Die Hard podcast for the casual fan.
And another one. My goodness.
So some big Toronto Blue Jays news dropping just now. Caitlin McGrath from The Athletic reporting that Nate Pearson, Nate the Great, actually on his way to Toronto to bolster this bullpen. No corresponding move has been reported yet. However, Nate the Great has been dominant in his time in AAA in 2023. He has gone from high leverage to the closer on that Bisons team. He has pitched 8.1 innings this year to a 2.16 ERA, or a FIP. FIP used the exact same way as ERA, but it gets rid of the defense and park metrics. A FIP of 1.42. Now, what has been very impressive about Nate Pearson this season is the fact that he is striking out almost 50% of the hitters that he is facing. That is something that this Toronto Blue Jays bullpen is lacking a little bit, right? High velo strikeout guy, and Nate Pearson looks to be that dude. Now, his walk rate is a little high, currently walking 14.3% of the hitters that he's facing. But at a 46% strikeout rate, you kind of take what you get. He has struggled a little bit staying on the field. That has been the big Achilles heel with Nate Pearson. Since he was touted as that number one prospect in all of baseball back in 2020, he has gone through the gauntlet. He's gone through arm injuries. Heck, the dude had such bad luck, he even wound up with a bout of mono. But he's back on the field. He looks strong. He looks healthy. And he's hitting 100 miles an hour. He is going to be in this Blue Jays bullpen starting today against the White Sox. Good news for all us Jays fans. All the best to Nate Pearson. Hope he really has a solid start to the 2023 season with this big league club.
Very excited to once again be joined by today's guest, host of the Shea Stadium podcast, and known to most of you as Jolly Olive, baseball content creator extraordinaire from John Boy Media. Welcome back to the Walk Off, Jack. Thanks so much for taking the time, buddy.
Thanks for having me, guys. Happy weekend to you guys. Got a big series win.
Huge series win. Love to see that sort of series win. Before we get into this, man, I do want to just mention your Jason Bay video, and this could just be because Canadian, but absolutely loved it, man. Absolutely loved it. He has such an interesting and tumultuous career, and I loved you telling the story of it. So great job, buddy.
Yeah, no, it's one of my favorite videos that I've done. It didn't do particularly well, but I still really enjoyed making it. It's a tough pill to swallow for Mets fans because that was a big deal at the time. But he had a great career, and a lot of those early Pirates teams had a lot of stars that, you know, they just couldn't put it together.
Truly, truly. And we're going to talk some Mets here. We do have some listener questions for you as well.
Awesome.
But I just love hearing what, like, out-of-market guys think about the Blue Jays. So let's start with Chris Bassitt, obviously.
Yeah.
A member of the New York Mets last year. Pitched very well for you guys. He was blowing up in his first start with the Blue Jays. So, of course, the Jays fan base, myself included, had a mini panic attack just because of the question marks already surrounding Jose Berríos and Yusei Kikuchi, and the thought of three question marks in a rotation that was supposedly going to be improved was a scary proposition. But he has settled right in. He's looking great his last three starts. What do you like about Chris Bassitt, and what were your thoughts on Toronto going out and grabbing him for 3 years?
Well, my coworker, Jake, called it his favorite signing of the offseason, and I thought it was one of the best as well, because starting pitching, while plentiful, was a lot of the older guys that were available. There weren't a lot of guys before age 30 that were going to get signed. And for Chris Bassitt, I thought that wherever he went, I didn't think he was going to be a New York Met, but wherever he went, I thought he was going to fit in well. And he fit in perfectly because he's not really, you know, he's not a number one, in my opinion, but he's a great number two, a great number three. And you guys had Gausman and Manoah, and that was sort of a perfect piece to fit in there, especially if Berríos can come around and find it again like he did that year where you guys first had him. For Bassitt, my main thing was, can he adapt to the pitch clock? Because I watched all 32 starts of his last year. Very methodical, slow worker with seven different pitches, a lot to think about, a lot to communicate to his catcher. And we kind of saw it on full display in his wild card start where things kind of blew up on him. And in that first start against the Cardinals, I could tell that it was bothering him a little bit. He was still getting adjusted to that pitch clock, having to work a little bit faster when he's normally very meticulous with his pitch selection and stuff like that. But it seems like he's easing in really quickly, which is great. He hasn't faced, you know, easy offenses. He took on, if I'm looking right, the Angels and the Houston Astros, and it was two of his last three starts, and he looked really good. And that's what you're going to get with Chris Bassitt. He's got a bunch of different pitches. So he can keep people on their toes. He doesn't need to overpower anybody with his velocity. And when he's on, you know, he can give you seven innings. He can really eat a large portion of the game and help out your bullpen.
That has been impressive to me, is just the fact that he is going six, seven innings so early into the season already. He's kind of showing that he can eat some innings. And he's so calm. Like, I just love his presence, man. There's no shaking that dude.
Definitely.
Last week we were very lucky to be joined by Rob Friedman. So the pitching ninja joined us, and he was talking
to you guys,
right? Hey, moving up. Kevin Gausman, he can't say enough good things about the dude. He actually mentioned that he thinks his splitter is like a top five pitch, like ever in baseball, which is about as nice of a compliment as you can give a pitcher, basically. When you look at this Jays team, who stands out to you? Who do you view as a guy who could possibly help put this team into the playoffs?
I'm going to cheat a little bit. I'm not going to talk about the starters. I'm going to talk about your bullpen. I'm going to talk about Eric Swanson, because you guys made a trade for him this offseason that a lot of people, including myself, were like, what? Why are they trading Teoscar Hernandez? That doesn't make sense. And it was because, one, the Jays wanted to prioritize, I think, fixing their defense and their base running a little bit, which has clearly worked out so far. And two, they kind of need another weapon in that bullpen, because I don't know if you can, no offense to your guys, but I don't know if you can truly rely on great years year in and year out from guys like Yimi and Simber and stuff like that. You need someone that was a bona fide stud and also a little bit newer to the league, not as known. And Eric Swanson was exactly that. He's also got a ton of years of control too, so you guys are going to have him for a while. And he's looked great so far. He's got an ERA below two. You guys don't need him to be the closer because you have a great one in Jordan Romano. And I think that he was just a perfect, perfect add to this bullpen, a bullpen that's been really healthy so far. So I hope that continues to stay as the trend.
Yeah, Eric Swanson was, like you said, a kind of a surprising pickup. But you're right, man. He has really settled in as that eighth inning guy for this Jays team, and has really dominated. Not to bring up a sore spot. Can Edwin Diaz, there's just no replacing that, right?
It's tough, man. I mean, the bullpen for the Mets has been great so far, and it's been a lot of the
depth guys stepping up. They really have, like, surprisingly good.
Yeah. And I'm very, very thankful that somehow David Robertson could not find a better deal than 1 year, $10 million, because he's looked unbelievable so far in that closer role. And it's just, it's something to think about with these great years we're having so far from Robertson and Ottavino and Brooks Raley, that if you had Edwin Diaz on top of that, you're talking about maybe the best bullpen in baseball. But still, we'll take it. They've been great so far.
It's funny how relievers, even a guy with the track record of David Robertson, it's just like, sometimes there's still just nothing you can do. It's just like year to year, nobody trusts you. Like,
you know exactly what you're getting, and he's still great. That's just a great reliever.
So speaking of great relievers, obviously with Edwin Diaz, you're very familiar with what a great closer is. Where does Jordan Romano stack up in the tiering of closers?
It's a good question, because the I feel like the closer field is very top heavy right now. Like, you kind of know who your top five guys are, and then it's very spread out. Like, I think of Bednar, I think of Edwin, I think of Clase sort of as that top echelon. I think Jordan Romano is right underneath that, partially because we haven't seen him for that long, and I've seen him have a couple blow up innings. But in terms of track record, it's now been, I'm going to include 2020 here, it's been 3 years in a row where he's been very, very good, top of the league type stuff. And we need to see him sort of get a deeper run, if that makes sense. Because what separates closers from the pack is how they perform in the highest leverage spots. And that's just not the regular season alone. It's the postseason as well. And I think we're on the verge of seeing that for him. Let's see. He's in his age 30 season now. So you're starting to get into these prime years for Romano. And I think that he has a great pitch mix. I think that his velocity is there with the best of them. And he's just got to conquer some demons this year. And I think he's perfectly capable of doing it. So I'd say he's right below that S-tier echelon.
One thing that Romano does do really well is it's almost, he plays off his slider so much, to the point where if you're a hitter, like, it would almost be impossible not to go in looking for the slider. But that, you know, as soon as you throw 99, it's just such a like blowback pitch of like, oh crap, okay, right, he's got that fastball there. When you think of a closer, you can do it on two pitches, right? Like two pitches is fine.
Almost traditionally, you'd say you
traditionally,
want to do it on two pitches.
Yeah,
I'd say so. But I mean, he has some of the best two pitch combos in the game. I mean, the fastball and slider really play. I think if he can get his walks down, that's mm-hmm. the biggest thing, because that's the last thing you want to see from your closer in the ninth inning is a free base runner. If a guy gets a hit off Edwin Diaz, it's obviously getting hit hard and he's earned it. But Edwin Diaz, a great thing he didn't do last year was he didn't walk a lot of guys at all. So you never had to really worry about that. If a team was beating Diaz, they beat him clean. I think for Romano, if he can eliminate that and just really command the zone as best as he can, he's going to be very hard to hit.
Even more so with Romano's biggest Achilles heel is when there's runners on base, he's a different pitcher. So like putting them on base, not good.
No, sir.
AL East already shaping up to be a dogfight once again. The Rays have three freaking losses. I mean, I can't say enough about them. Like they find a way every year. The yeah. Orioles are in second place. And listen, I truly do think Baltimore is a good team. I think they're going to regress, but I mean, they are right there in the thick of things. Boston is in last place in that division, one game over 500, and would be tied for first in the AL Central. What do you expect out of the AL East with so many question marks in that division?
See, it's so weird because while all the teams are playing really well, the outlooks of the teams are completely different. Like, I think Red Sox fans are kind of like thinking if we can get over 500 and sneak our way into a wild card, that's a victory for this season, which is kind of a retool, not really a rebuild. For the Orioles, you know, they're looking towards the future is now. And like they took a step forward last year. This year, they want to get into the dance. Yankees is always the Yankees, win the division, you know, take care of business, that kind of thing. And then the Rays always find a way. For the Blue Jays, it's kind of been, we need to take the next step. We've been gradually building for a while. 2021 should have been that playoff year. They got a little snubbed at the end. That was a tough pill to swallow. Last year, they were great. Got an early exit like my Mets. This year, we got to make it again. We got to win a playoff series. We got to get farther than we did. We have to continue progress going forward. And with them right now, they have a tough schedule ahead of them, these Blue Jays. I'm looking at it right now because I was curious. Mariners, Red Sox, Pirates, who are great right now, mm-hmm. Phillies, Braves, Yankees, Orioles, Rays. That's through the end of May. So really no breather in there except for this upcoming series with the White Sox. So for me, the Blue Jays kind of have to prove it against the above 500 teams because I think you're no longer going to get to beat up within your division. Not that you would have anyway. All these teams are great. Mm-hmm. It's going to be about beating the winning teams from other divisions and from the National League. And if the Blue Jays can beat other winning teams, I think that gives them such a massive edge rather than just winning their head-to-heads, which they did against the Rays and the Yankees. That's the first piece of the puzzle. The second piece is, okay, now go out of the AL East and prove that you're better than those teams as well.
Jack, I'm so curious on your thoughts on the Orioles because I do like the Orioles. Yeah. I predicted at the beginning of the season that they're actually going to take a step back from last year with their wins and that next year will be the year where they're really a thorn in everyone's side and really going to compete for a playoff spot. Where are you at on the Orioles? I just look at their youth and the fact that they're putting so many of their eggs in the Gunnar Henderson and the Rushman baskets. And again, they're both studs and they're going to be incredible. It's just a lot to put on guys who don't even have a full year of service time in the major leagues. Where are you at on the Baltimore Orioles?
Yeah, no, it's a good question because they got a lot of breakout performances last year. Their young guys stepped up really, really quickly, which doesn't happen that often. And when I guest started on Talking Baseball a month ago, we were supposed to highlight one team that we thought would get off to a hot start. I looked at their April schedule and I said, hey, if they can go out there and win 16 games in April like they should with this schedule, they're going to be in a good spot. Right now they're 14-7. So they've been taking care of business. They swept the Tigers. They swept the Nationals. They beat the White Sox. They haven't
the teams they should beat. They have
the
been
teams
beating.
They should beat. They're beating, which is what we expect to them. The problem is they lost a series against the Yankees. They lost a series against the Red Sox. Those are series they need to clean up and win because they got to beat the guys in their division. And right now they're playing well. Rushman is doing his thing. He's got a 152 OPS plus, but they're also relying on some pretty imbalanced stats. Like Jorge Mateo has an OPS above 1000. I don't think that's going to stick at the end of the season. But with all that being said, they're fast. They play great defense. They're clutch hitting. The thing that worries me is their rotation. They didn't spend enough money this offseason to really convince me that it's going to be great. They have guys that were good last year and have been good this year, but they already sent down Cole Irvin, who was a big trade piece for them. They didn't really trade or sign for anybody big, so they're going to need those guys to kind of just come up big again, or else this bullpen is going to have to throw like four innings a game, and that is a recipe for disaster. So I'm curious. I got to see in a month or so where they're at.
Yeah, they're going to be an interesting team to follow this year. There's so many scenarios where they could literally, like, anything could happen. I wouldn't be shocked if they're in it right till the end. I also wouldn't be shocked if they fall right off of the rails. So that'll be a fun one to watch.
Are the Orioles going to be spenders this offseason? Free agency?
This offseason, they should. I don't know if they're going to be buyers at the deadline, because that's a much harder question to answer. But this offseason, there's no reason, because one, it's a lighter free agent market. So I think volume and money will be down outside of Ohtani, obviously. And part of that is that, you know, they didn't spend at all. They signed Adam Frazier, and that might have been it. I think they got Michael Givens. They need to spend big this offseason, at least on one guy, to kind of anchor a rotation or even a lineup piece around, because, you know, like, we talk about the Orioles teams from a decade ago that were winning the AL East and getting into the playoffs pretty much every year. They spent big. They went out there and they got guys. You know, they got Mark Trumbo, who led the AL in home runs that one year. That was a free agent signing.
Yeah.
So there's no reason why Baltimore exactly. They were a really good team. And there's no reason why they can't go out there and do it again outside of, you know, giving their young guys the keys. It helps to have a veteran around. So I hope they do that.
Pete Alonso is on fire to start this season, and you see him play almost every day. He's one of the reasons I'm actually really excited about the schedule being more balanced and getting to see some more National League teams. Right. We never get to see Pete Alonso as Blue Jays fans, so it's very exciting. For those of us who haven't got to see him over the past few years, tell us about the impact that Pete Alonso has on this Mets team, and why is he the real home run king in New York?
Ooh. I like the spice at the end of that question. I mean, it's plain and simply put, if the Mets didn't have Pete Alonso in their lineup, they'd have a massive problem, because they have a lineup of nine guys and eight of them specialize in getting on base. And the one guy who doesn't, I mean, I'm giving Francisco Lindor not enough credit there. Well, the one guy who focuses on mashing the ball is Pete Alonso. He's the guy driving them all in, and that's what makes this lineup go. And I think the difference this year is that Alonso was a very traditional slugger, a guy that you could definitely see slotting in a DH at some point in his career. Didn't play great first base, you know, struck out a lot, didn't swing great pitches all the time, but when he got one that he liked, he crushed it. This year, his plate discipline has been the best of his career. His out-of-zone swing rate is down 10%. He's not chasing as much. He's in the highest peripherals of most of those categories. He's halfway on strikeout percentage, which is about where you want him to be. And also, he's playing great defense this year. He's 90th percentile, and that's above average. So Pete Alonso is refining his game, which is something that I didn't think he needed to do, being a 40 home run, 100 RBI guy year in and year out. But this takes him from, you know, all-star to MVP conversation, which is exactly what the Mets need. And I hope Steve Cohen is thinking about opening up the checkbook one more time and locking down one more piece, because he's the guy you really need to keep around.
This is where Jays fans and Mets fans have a similar wish list here. It's lock up our first baseman. Please. Give them all the money.
Please.
So I don't want to throw salt on this wound, but I just am so curious about where you're at on it. Carlos Correa debacle. Can you see his face and not have your emotions spike in one way or another?
You know, that was such a weird 3-week period. It really was such a haze, because, you know, like, it happened and I was confused and then really happy and thought about it for a while as it continued to not be finalized. And it's an extremely small sample size, but he's not off to a great start this year. And I constantly think about what the headlines would have been if Correa was having that start to the year in New York. And I just think that this team is great. They're 14-9 right now. They have half their roster on the IL, and they just went 7-3 on their West Coast trip. And not to say that they wouldn't love having Carlos Correa in this lineup, but this is a team that can succeed without him and maybe pocket that money for an Alonso extension or adding somebody else this offseason or something like that. And while it would have been very, very cool to see him and Lindor share the left side of the infield, it's kind of in my rearview mirror. I think it would have been a lot tougher if he went to like the Braves or the Phillies or something where I'd have to watch him play all the time. But if he's out there in Minnesota and I see him one series a year, okay, that's fine.
Okay, so this is something I was thinking over the off season. Does your team having all the money and when they lose out on a free agent, does it hurt more?
No, I think it hurts less, honestly.
Okay.
Because I, you know, I grew up with this team, so I was there during the Wilpon ownership. And when we didn't get our guy, the offseason ended, basically, because there was no pivot move. Yeah. You know, people weren't dying to come play for the Mets. So you mentioned at the top of the episode, the Jason Bay video, you know, when we got Jason Bay, I was like, holy shit, we got Jason Bay.
They
we
did actually it.
Got
yeah.
somebody coming off like a 40 home run year. Then of course he was terrible, but like that sense of elation probably was more magnified back then because we weren't used to getting just anybody that we wanted. Whereas this year, you know, we got the Brandon Nimmo deal and I was excited about that. The David Robertson deal happened on the same day and I barely gave it any attention. And he's turned out to be one of the most important members of the team so far this year. And that's just kind of the status of the team. They go out there and they get the weapons they need because they have the resources that they're willing to spend, unlike other teams. And I hope that other teams kind of step up to the plate with us to make it a little bit more competitive.
Oh, me too, man. That is one thing I really want to see out of the Jays. And listen, the Jays, I'm not even complaining about where they're at on their spending right. because they are right there in the top 10, even pushing that top five overall, you know, like they're finally at the luxury tax for the first time ever.
Can I ask you two a question?
Yes.
What do you think that Matt Chapman's going to get this offseason?
Buddy, I was just...
I don't care as long as it's in Canadian dollars. How's that sound?
He's having a great year so far, man.
Typical freaking year right before free agency, yep. eh? Like that walk year, man, there is some magic in that walk year. And it's funny because I was literally getting to Matt Chapman.
Yep.
And if they're, you know, that hole at third base, I wouldn't even call it a hole at third base for the Mets, but definitely a place where they could.
He's hitting the market at a beautiful time, man. Oh. He's last year. I don't know if he would have gotten the kind of deal that he's going to get this year, because especially with Machado signing.
I was just going to say the fist yeah. pumping he had to have done when San yep. Diego re-upped on him. Like,
not yeah. so true. Cause now he's one of the top position players on the market, maybe the top position player. And he's having his best offensive year ever so far. Like mm-hmm. he's on pace for it. Yeah, talk about a perfect time to be at your best, 30-year-old Matt Chapman.
Especially after we just watched Trey Turner take that mega deal.
Yep.
Because there has been some trepidation amongst organizations around the league over the last little while to give that sort of money to someone who just hit 30, because you see it time and time again not work out.
Of course.
Matt Chapman, do you feel it's a 10-year deal? Like, do you think he's that kind of guy?
Well,
at least in the market with no one else.
No, yeah, there are things you have to weigh into it. Two things that I heavily weigh are things that can potentially age better than other things, which are, I think, defense, because Matt Chapman has always been a great defender at third base, yes. and that's really, really valuable. And he's always been a disciplined hitter for the most part. I think in recent years, maybe not so much, but like in those early or those late 2010s years with the A's, where he was slugging but also walking a lot. We're seeing that a lot this year.
Yes,
so far. So I think those two things can translate really well. I don't know if he's a 10-year guy. I think that I don't think people are ready for the fact that I think the contracts are going to be smaller this year, because I think everyone's putting their eggs in the Ohtani basket and they all mm-hmm. want to put up their best offer possible, because he will get 20 offers from 20 teams. I don't think that's a naive thing to say. And with that, I think all these teams are going to be kind of spending on the back end a little bit, like not as much focused on these players, but rather focused on the chance of getting Ohtani. And that could affect a guy like Matt Chapman, who I think will still get a 7 to 8 year deal pretty easily, because he's only 30 years old and he gives you 30 home run, 100 RBI, great defense potential. There's no reason why he shouldn't get a great deal. It won't be at that Trey Turner level, though, I don't think.
Right. Probably he'll break 200,000 or 200 million.
Yes. Yeah. I think he will break that 200 mark.
Before we move on, you did mention Shohei. Do you see him as the first guy to hit half a billion?
Yeah, I think he might blow past it too. And I think there's only one team that can go out there and give it to him. That's the Los Angeles Dodgers.
Yeah, Did you by chance? Oh, go ahead, Adam.
No, I was just going to jump in with a Padres question that we have from one of our friends here. Garth says, last year, Juan Soto turned down $440 million from the Nationals.
He did do that.
First 4 years of his career, he was hitting .301, slugging .550. The last 2 years, hitting .236 with a slug of .443, including a .198 this year with .308. Point of the question, was Juan Soto, is that a big misstep on his part? Is he going to get more than that when he becomes a free agent? And how this ties into the Ohtani topic, if you're the Padres, do you just let Juan Soto walk after the big trade and spend your money? Like, if you're if you brought in Juan Soto, the plan must have been, we have $500 million to give this guy when he's due. Is there a recalculation going on in San Diego? And if they're not going to give it to him, maybe Ohtani gets money from the Padres.
Because if you're the Padres, you have to think about the fact that there's a reason the Dodgers didn't do anything this past offseason, and it's because they want to go get Shohei Ohtani. Mm-hmm. You can really stick it to the Dodgers if you go out there and swipe him. And yeah, if you're asking me right now if I would give Juan Soto $440 million, the answer is no. And obviously it's recency bias, and we know what he's capable of. But right now, he's not that player. And it doesn't help that he plays horrible defense in right field. So you'd have to be your prototypical DH. And that's a 10-year commitment to a very valuable spot of your lineup. And if he doesn't produce, that's a huge anchor to your payroll and your roster. Juan Soto is going to be fine. He's Juan Soto. He's a generational hitter. He's the modern Ted Williams. But right now, he doesn't have it. And I think that he took a huge risk betting on himself, not taking that $440 million, which I do think was spread out over a lot of years, which is partially the reason why. I think the AAV was lower than people would expect. But with all that being said, I don't know if he is still going to be able to get that, especially if this trend continues where he's not really hitting with the Padres. I think things will balance out, but I think it's going to be a very interesting thing to look back on once his new deal is finalized, whoever it's with.
Speaking of deals, Manny Machado, he's got to be just, I am not worthying his agent constantly, right? Like,
sure, there was a steak dinner or two involved.
Oh my God. I mean, perfect storm, because the Padres were just blowing the cap and just spending as much money as humanly possible. And, you know, their face, because last year, the Padres were a great story. They didn't have the face of their franchise. He was suspended for PEDs, and they still went out there and competed with the Dodgers all year long. They beat the Dodgers in the playoffs and my Mets, and they made it, I think, two wins shy of a World Series with, you know, without one of their key pieces. Then this year, you're faced with the question of, you know, one of those key pieces that really carried the load last year might walk, because he might, if he does walk, he's the second biggest free agent on the market. Normally, he'd probably be the first, if not for Ohtani. So I think they did what most other franchises would do, and they handed him the blank check, and they gave him that money. It's just the caveat of also the fact that they paid Xander Bogaerts previously, right before that. So the Padres are, I don't know how much more money they could have. I don't know where it's coming from, whether San Diego is built on gold and they're just mining it. We have no idea. But I have no idea how they have all this money and they have $500 million more for Ohtani or Soto. It's really bizarre. And I don't know how well the contract will age, because it's 11 years. And that's a really long time, and he's 31. But it's also Manny Machado, and that's a great piece to have in your lineup, even with his slow start to the year.
Jack, go back 3 years. What is the percentage you would have put on Manny Machado opting out of that contract?
Oh, my God. I mean, it's so weird, because the talk of last year's playoffs were like how well the Machado and Harper contracts aged. Because at the time, you know, I think everybody was like, well, that's a lot of money for these two guys. That's a time. I almost was like, I'm glad my team didn't do that. And that's foolish to think about right now, especially Harper's deal. Harper's deal looks amazing. For Machado, I mean, I never would have thought that he opted out.
Right. Then, I put a zero. I was like, there's like no way he opted out.
1 or 2%. Like, he would have to ascend to being the best player in baseball. And while he did ascend to being like a top five player in the National League, the landscape of player contracts just changed completely, to the point where he was arguably underpaid, which is a foolish thing to say, but it's very true in the landscape of things, especially with how the Padres spend. So when it did come time for the opt-out, it made perfect sense to me.
between Mets fans and Jays fans, who dislikes Yankees the most?
Oh, Jays fans. Jays fans, 100,000%. Like this more recently, you know, if you go back to like early 2000s, it's Mets fans because we had the World Series and the Yankees were a dynasty. Right now, the level of venom between the Jays and the Yankees is like rivaling Red Sox-Yankees because the Red Sox just aren't that competitive right now. And it's very, very clear, at least to me, because, you know, the Rays are 19-3. They're a wagon. But the race in my mind is still Blue Jays-Yankees for the division, just like it was last year. And I just think that there's a huge chip on the Jays' shoulder. They retooled their roster. They added some people to fine-tune things. And they have a chance right now to capitalize because the Yankees are very injured and they're trying out their young guys and their bench is thin and they have a tough schedule ahead of them that the Jays can sort of leap out in front and maybe stay in front if they can capitalize over this next month or so of their schedule. But it also involves going to Yankee Stadium and beating the Yankees and then welcoming them to Rogers Center and also beating them. I think they're going to be one of the more fun rivalries to watch last year because I feel like the rivalry of last year during the regular season, at least, was Mets Braves, and that turned out to go in the Braves' favor. And it's not fun to be on the losing end. So I wish you guys the best of luck because it's tough.
Well, appreciate that. I think it's even being ramped up a little bit too because of the individual rivalries that are happening too. The Manoa and Cole, and then Vladdy
Manoa
versus
just transforms, man, when he gets to the Bronx.
Doesn't he? Like he goes to New York, and it's just like that is his spot. And then Vladdy versus just the entire Yankee fan base is kind of a fun little rivalry there.
It's nuts, man. It's nuts.
So I read that Jim Bowden article in The Athletic back in February. And of course, that thing keeps circulating as more and more talk about expansion happening. And of course, this Oakland debacle and it looking like it's finally somewhat being resolved. We'll see. I'll believe it when I actually see them in Vegas. But have you seen the proposed new divisions that he has kind of dreamed up based solely on the geography?
I have.
You have?
They feel a little, let's see how many people we can get to reply to this tweet or comment on this article, because they seemed a little ridiculous, especially in the current landscape of how those teams look. Like, I think one of the divisions was Nationals, Reds, Pirates, something or other.
Yes. And Charlotte, the expansion and, team. Charlotte, the expansion team in there.
Of course. And I think there's one of two ways you can go about it. The way I would prefer, and I think this might shock a lot of people, is just abolish divisions entirely. And I know it hurts rivalries, but I do think that if you're going to have everybody play everybody, then maybe you should just get rid of divisions entirely and the best six teams just make the playoffs, because you run into a lot of wonky scenarios with the Central, with the division winner there being like the fifth or sixth best team in their league, just because of region, they get a little advantage. And there was a lot of talk last year about, oh, do the wildcard teams get an advantage because they don't have this bye and yada, yada, yada. And they can set up their rotation. But I just think that having everybody play everybody kind of lends itself to the old ways of baseball, meaning there was the National League and the American League, and the best teams from each league come out on top, and then they play each other at the end. I think that having 30 teams in one pool would get a little, I don't know how much I like that, because there is something special about the two separate leagues that every sport has. But I don't know. I don't think more divisions is the answer.
I feel the exact same way, my dude. Yeah. And this is something that I just like, I look at these divisions that are, and of course they're imaginary dreamed up divisions, but I mean, you look at the North, and I'm all for it, where they put the Jays, right? It's Cincinnati, Cleveland, Detroit,
you guys are
Toronto.
Pretty.
Yeah. Right. But then you look at this proposed division, the East Division, and it's the Red Sox, the Mets, the Yankees, and the Phillies.
Yeah,
how would
you understand
feel about
why I'm opposed?
Right? Like,
to this?
Like, you're like, don't do that.
That's almost as good as the current AL East.
Yeah, like, Jesus Christ. I don't want to be a part of that, guys. You guys look stressed out.
How do you feel about having two Los Angeleses in the same division or two New Yorks in the same division? Because obviously, there would be some pretty cool rivalry stuff to come from that as well. But is that just too much?
I don't know, because we see it in basketball with Nets and Knicks. Yeah. We don't see it in football with Giants and Jets. And there is something there to an inner city rivalry. Mets Yankees can lend itself to be a great rivalry. We see it during the Subway Series. But I think the more special rivalries come from team history and stuff like that, like Yankees, Red Sox, and Dodgers, Giants, and all the and Dodgers, Padres recently. Those I find more interesting because they're much larger than just battle for city supremacy. And while it would be easy to sell that and spin that in any sport, not just baseball, I would like to see the Mets play the Yankees more because I think they always put on a good show. Like every, like, I still think of that 2021 series with Lindor's 3 home runs. Mets weren't competitive at that point. The Yankees were having a weird kind of sad season, even though they were in the playoffs. And that still turned out to be a great, fun series because these two teams, whenever they come together, some special happens. And I think the same could happen with the Dodgers and Angels.
Okay, so we're going to get to some listener questions for you here, Jack. Sweet. But before that, can fans ever be happy? Listen, in 2018, I remember looking at Yankees fans and they would just infuriate me, right? Mm. The Jays are in the middle of a rebuild. And I remember even saying, if my team was a winning team, I would never be so constantly negative and entitled and constantly wanting more. But here we are, 2023. And let me tell you, Jack, I just want more. Like, if the Jays don't go to a championship series or the World Series, like I'm losing it.
That's what I'm saying, though, because everything changes with your own perspective. Because Mets fans, I'm watching the evolution of Mets fans right now. They're becoming monsters, especially with the young kids coming up and not immediately hitting 300. And expectations change when you win for the first time. And Jays fans should not be satisfied with just winning 90 games, because mm-hmm. I would consider winning 90 games, getting into the playoffs, and losing again a failure. There has to be some sign of progress. Otherwise, why are we watching 162 games of this if there's no point to trending upwards? So I think that it's cool to an extent because they can get a little out of balance when you're making the playoffs 30 years in a row and then things get a little crazy. But I'm glad that you kind of had that turnaround in your mentality.
Yeah. Okay, we'll throw to Adam here. Honestly, Jack, thank you so much for taking the time to join us, buddy. We really do enjoy talking baseball with you, and I love the content you create, and so appreciate you being so generous with your time here.
Thanks, guys. I always like coming on here, so thank you for having me.
All right, first one comes in from Devin. Says, if playoffs started today, 4 AL East teams would be in the playoffs. Is this sustainable? Even a 5% chance. Is this mathematically possible by the end
of
the year?
Okay, so... Let's be honest with ourselves. So there's going to be one team that comes from the Central, right? I think we'd be a little surprised if it was both Twins and Guardians. I think that would be a little out of the ordinary. In the West, I think you could see two teams. Houston's going to win it, and then I think you could see Seattle. Texas is hot right now. I don't know how much that's going to last, but
how much do you really believe in the Rangers? Do you have any faith?
I don't like the Rangers lineup. I don't believe in it in the long term. The pitching staff, you know, if you buy a pitching staff, it's going to be good, and it's been great so far. But everyone has to stay healthy, and the bottom half of that lineup needs to just have guys that are going to have breakout years the entire year, and you can't rely on that. So I could eat my words on the Rangers, but I've been saying that all offseason. I got to stick with it. And then when it comes to the East, I fully expect the Yankees, Rays, and Jays to be there. So it's a question of, do the Orioles or the Red Sox get into that winning season and sniff that potential? I think the answer is it's an entirely realistic possibility that there's 4 AL East teams and 3 of them claim the wildcard spots, because I like the Orioles. And hey, the Red Sox in 2013 looked like shit in the first half of the season and they went on to win the World Series. So anything can happen when you kind of have that magic lineage like the Red Sox do. So it comes down to, can the Mariners repeat their success? Can the Rangers step up, or will the Central finally not be embarrassing? But I think I would bet on the East being great before any of those things.
Well,
if that happened, that would be the best example for your no more division argument.
Spread them out. Yeah. Just spread them out. Because then we could have 5 AL East teams in the playoffs.
There you go. Okay, two more to get to. First one is Bryce Harper. Mm. Is he a first baseman in 2024? Or is this strictly a creative rehab strategy?
That's a really good question, actually. I don't think Bryce Harper wants to play first base. I think Bryce Harper's got a cannon for an arm, and what a waste it would be to have him sitting at first base with that arm. But this season, I think it's a perfectly fine and creative solution to your problem, because having someone take up your DH spot, unless they're, you know, Bryce Harper level, is tough, because you want to be able to rotate guys in and out of there and like utilize that spot to its fullest potential. And having Bryce play first base is a really good recipe, because they don't have Reese all year.
Especially with Hoskins So that's a great point. Yeah.
And the thing with that is that I think right field is a harder position to fill than first base. They're both easier than most positions, but if you can put Bryce in right field and go sign a first baseman for $20 million, which is probably what Philly's budget is right now with all the money they've been handing out, I think that's a much better recipe for future success. And also Bryce Harper is an athlete, and I think he wants to go play a more athletic position. So this year, I think he's a first baseman. The future, I think he's still a right fielder.
All right, last one comes from Donna. Donna wants to know, would the Blue Jays be a better team in 2023, this year, if they asked Bo Bichette to move to second base and had Santiago Espinal replace him at shortstop?
That's a good question. I don't know, maybe it's just me, but I really like watching Bo play the field. I just like watching Bo play in general. I feel like he's extremely underrated because we're just in a really good crop of a shortstop talent right now. I don't think his talent is so much of a net negative that it warrants him moving position. And maybe that's just because I don't watch him enough, but I watched the Yankee series. I thought he looked good. And I think that, again, it comes down to the filling position model that I talked about before. I think the Jays would have a lot easier time keeping Bo at short and then maybe trading for a potentially great second baseman at the deadline if that becomes a position of need, which right now it looks like it is, because I don't think this is a Biggio believer pod. It doesn't really seem like it is, bearing that question. And you look at this lineup top to bottom, especially with Kiermaier playing well. Second base, if you can fill that hole, this is a really potent lineup. And there are guys out there that can fill that position. And I think Bo lends himself talent-wise better as a shortstop, especially for the future, because he can develop more and more into a great defender, especially with a guy like Matt Chapman on the side that can really help him, you know, like fine-tune his things. I think moving, you know, Vladdy is a much different case because he was at third base and it was a clear problem. You moved him to first and you solved that problem. With Bo, it's still a middle infield position. I don't think the difference between shortstop and second base, shortstop is the hardest position on the field, but second base is still a tough position to play. And I think Bo has all the talent in the world and he can piece things together and make them click.
Love it. Thank you, buddy. Really appreciate you coming on and lending your baseball mind.
Appreciate you guys for having me, as always.
Thanks for listening to the Walk Off Podcast with Scott Belford and Adam Mack, with a new episode every Friday.
Oscar with a drive. Cheese and cracker shows to pitch to him. Wrong move.
Thanks for listening.